This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded November 1st, I think, 2012. We're at the Build Conference in Redmond, and I'm talking to Aaron Stannard, and today I'm talking to him about his new startup, MarkedUp. So first of all, we were coworkers until very recently. So you want to talk about how you've gotten from where you were to where you are today?
Yeah, sure thing, John. And thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. I guess my story with sort of leaving Microsoft should probably start with how I got there in the first place.
Sure.
So I'm the, you know, my father has been a serial entrepreneur in the original tech boom back in the early 80s. So he built a company in San Diego that specialized in doing, you know, word processing and writing some of the really early printer drivers and that sort of stuff for the Apple II originally.
Wow.
So that's sort of where, and so I was sort of through osmosis brought into software entrepreneurship throughout the course of growing up. I saw him start a .com company in 1994, and it's called SmartDraw, and it's still an active, healthy company today with about, you know, 18 years later with, I think, 50 employees now. So, you know, so I've sort of grew up around it, and decided at the age of, at the age of 24 to go and try and start my own first company, which was called Social Media Measurements. So don't bother looking it up. We never shipped a product. and that was a great exercise in what not to do with a startup. Biggest single thing I screwed up on was just not investing any time at all before I built the company, trying to build a network of people I could bounce ideas off of and get feedback.
So I
barked up a bunch of wrong trees and just realized real quickly that I was just flailing around.
So you're just making it up as you went, right?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Every startup to some extent is making it up as you go.
Sure.
But there's degrees of just how much crap you're making up every day.
And, right.
My social media measurements was just, you know, cluelessness at its utmost. So I folded it up. And one of the things I realized was after spending a couple of years working in marketing primarily, was that I let my technical chops get a little rusty. So I started listening to Herding Code a lot back then, actually.
I've heard that works.
And I started, and I attended SoCal Code Camp in San Diego that Woody Pewitt put on.
Sure. Yep.
And one of the things I realized at that event was just how little the sort of startup developer has in common with your average .NET developer. Most .NET developers are working in giant organizations, and they're dealing with either one really small piece of a big machine, or they're working on line of business apps or something. Whereas I was trying to build a consumer-facing product.
Right.
And so I have customers, not stakeholders. That's sort of a different way of talking about your software product.
Yeah.
So I wrote a blog post on my personal blog, Aaron on the Web, and it was basically about how I think the reason why .NET has been so slow to pick up in the startup community was really had more to do with the cultural differences between startup developers and .NET developers. And so I wrote a post about that in like July 4th, 2010, and just put it up there without much thought. Next thing I know, I'm getting hit with about 6,000 Redmond IP addresses. It's on the front page of Hacker News, and
right,
you know, that's. And I got a phone call from Joel, who ended up being a coworker on my team when I joined Microsoft, asking if hey, you know, getting .NET into the hands of startups is a big goal for Microsoft right now. We have the BizSpark program is about a year old, and there's a lot more we know we can do to fix it. And since you're in Southern California, I was in San Diego at the time.
Right.
We have a job opening for a startup developer evangelist in Los Angeles. And would you be interested in talking through it? Now, you know, having just come off the ashes of a failed startup, working for a big, safe company sounded like a good idea.
Right.
And so I joined Microsoft's Developer Platform Evangelism Division, which is, that's your new home.
That is mine. Now. Yep, yep. So, entered just before you left. I'm trying to think it's coincidence, but I don't know.
So I worked there for 2 years, working with early stage startup companies in LA and in the Bay Area too. And I was primarily focused on Windows Azure. I'd say that was probably the day-to-day, the thing I spent the most time working on. But I also did a fair amount of work on Windows Phone and eventually Windows 8 too. So then over the course of the summer of this year, you know, I was coming up with my second year anniversary at Microsoft. I took a look at the ecosystem and the landscape for Windows 8 and thought to myself, there's not a lot of service providers that are trying to go out there and really build an ecosystem for Windows 8 developers. There's no one really to help them measure how their apps are being used or trying to help them market it or trying to help them test it. There's just a lot of services that web developers in particular are used to having whenever they build a new product. And there's just nothing like that available for the WinRT experience. So I started working on Marked Up in my spare time, along with a couple of people that I had done some, who I had hired on at Microsoft to do consulting work for our partners before. Mm-hmm. And we ended up building a little prototype, and we really liked sort of where it, really liked what it did and thought it had a lot of potential. And I just made the call towards the end of July to leave Microsoft and work on Marked Up full time. And it was not an easy decision, not one that was made lightly. Microsoft is a fantastic employer, but at the end of the day, when it comes to starting a company, if you have an external event that looks really promising and it lines up really well with internal knowledge and skills, you should just jump on it because you don't get very many of those.
Yeah.
So that's what we did with Marked Up.
And you know, I was talking to you the other day when we figured out it would be a good idea to do an interview, and you know, I was saying the timing is incredible.
Yes.
It's like there's so many things all coming together at once. It's crazy seeing Microsoft deliver a bunch of releases all from different divisions all at the same time, and it all even looks coordinated. And mm-hmm. and like you're saying, there's a possibility of an ecosystem. So, I mean, the timing is really nice.
So I guess I should talk a little bit about what Marked Up does. So Marked Up does in-app analytics for WinRT and eventually Windows Phone 8. So if you want to figure out if you're a Windows 8 developer and you want to know how many people use your app every day, how much time they spend using it, what are the sorts of things they do, and which types of users end up actually, you know, buying an in-app purchase or converting from a trial to a paid version, Marked Up helps you measure all of them. So that's a
key thing, too. I think that is different from some other, I guess, kind of similar ecosystems, is that there's the whole trial
yes.
and purchase. Because, you know, people, I read recently somebody was saying, well, when you look at just numbers of apps in the store, a lot of numbers of apps, like say in the Android marketplace or Google Play or whatever we call it now, is there's trial and the real one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's maybe trial and pro and standard and all these other versions because you can't really just turn on features where you can do that in Windows 8.
Absolutely. Right? Well, in the Windows 8 store even takes it a step further where you have the notion of expiring licenses, both for in-app purposes and for premium licenses. Mm-hmm. So it makes it really easy for developers to roll their own subscription methodology if they want.
Okay.
And the Windows store to sort of takes care of it for you automatically. You know, the truth of the matter is with Windows 8 is that the economics of that marketplace are going to be radically different than iOS or Android or even Windows Phone. The truth of the matter with respect to where Microsoft's distribution is it's primarily on big form factor devices like laptops, desktops, and hopefully, you know, I got my Surface here at Build this week. Hopefully smaller form factor devices like that become more popular.
Right.
But in terms of where the, you know, majority of the spectrum of all the devices that WinRT will ship on, the vast majority of it is going to be x64-based hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And so those, you know, Metro-style apps are going to be used alongside Outlook and Office and Visual Studio and QuickBooks and Photoshop and all the other pieces of software, you know, traditional native Windows applications mm-hmm. that people are using to produce value every day. So your app really has the ability to be priced and treated like a desktop application, which fetches a lot more money in the purchasing economics are a lot closer to, you know, what you'd expect if you walked into a Best Buy and bought shrink wrap software. People will pay $40 a seat for something. Whereas on, you know, iOS, you'd be crazy to ask someone to pay $4 up front.
Right, right.
So, you know, I wrote a blog post about this, but iOS developers and, you know, really shot themselves in the foot with respect to how they went about monetizing their apps.
Kind of the whole race to the bottom thing, right?
Well, race to the bottom, but also it's sort of a hit-driven market in a big respect.
Right.
Unless your app has tens of millions of users and installs, the likelihood of you being able to use a freemium model to go and produce enough value to build a sustainable business out of it is very low. Unless you're in gaming, the likelihood of you being able to produce a sustainable business around a single set of apps is pretty low in that market.
Let's talk more about that, what you said in that post then. Your recommendation was that we as a community pursue a different, like, don't just try and crank out a bunch of small, cheap apps, but yes. work for a higher value apps.
So the big angle that I was going towards with that was you have to recognize that even though the Windows 8 store has a lot of the same sort of facets to it with respect to how you distribute apps and how they're bought and what the purchasing mechanisms look like, the economics of it are going to be very different by virtue of form factor and sort of the surrounding ecosystem on each user's machine. The fact that I can take data from my Metro-style app and paste it into, you know, Word or Outlook or Excel innately raises the value of what that app can do without the developer having to do anything special. So what I was encouraging developers to do was to take a not don't go ahead and take the, you know, the same economics and sort of design methodologies and monetization practices you had in iOS and translate them over to Windows 8 and expect a different result.
Right.
So do something different this time around. So the thing I was encouraging developers to do was really take advantage of what the platform has to offer. There was one app in particular I singled out, and I saw that on the blog post that I sent a few hundred clicks to this guy's app, so hopefully he made some money out of it. there was this little German company made an app called router.cockpit was the name of it. And what it did was it used...
How's that spelled? Router?
.cockpit. So okay. router.cockpit. Okay. So they probably need to work on naming their stuff a little bit. I have to imagine at that point when they ship their app, there are probably better names available in the Windows 8 store. But what this app does, it uses the built-in UPnP API inside WinRT to go and detect the speed between you, your router, and the actual internet itself. And it goes and plots the speeds in real time. It can show you where there's bottlenecks, where there might be issues. So we've actually used this for troubleshooting our network connection at work and at home, too.
Wow.
So, and the little app costs like $2 right now. And I was thinking, you know, they could probably take what they started there and extend it a lot more and turn it into a $20 app.
Right.
With the exact same distribution that they have today. Or even better, they can have a $2 app and then put in-app purchases in there for people like me who want a lot more information.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, that's just one example of something you can do really easily on WinRT that you can't on iOS. On iOS, you have to write your own UPnP driver or borrow someone else's.
Huh.
And I don't think there's a sane person listening to this podcast right now who would look at that and go, oh, that's trivial.
Yeah. Well, you never know.
Yeah. Oh, UPnP device driver, yeah. I'll have that done before lunch. So that's the bottom line that I was trying to get at with respect to the economics of the Windows 8 store. You have to take a look at the ecosystem and take a step back and don't just replicate whatever you did for Windows Phone or iOS and expect any different outcome. You'll get the same, you know, relatively same number of downloads and usage patterns and the exact same sort of economics where it's like, man, I've got 20,000 installs that I made $6.
Yeah.
and the other thing I should throw out there is advertising is not a very scalable model unless you have, you know,
unless you
have a huge number of users or you do something ridiculous like throw interstitial ads that you try to force people to click on or something. The thing you should take a look, you know, when I saw that Apple announced they had paid out, you know, $6 billion to developers total from their app store over the course of what, 3 years now? Maybe 3.5-4 years. $6 billion over 4 years with 600,000 apps in the market. And about, you know, I think, let's go ahead and assume like 300,000 publishers or so. I haven't seen the exact number from App Annie in a while. I looked at that and I thought, that's terrible. Even Rovio and all those other, you know, companies that people are thinking are going to go public haven't been able to do more than this over this much time. You know, Microsoft, for every dollar Microsoft makes, its partners make 7. So you have like this $500 trillion ecosystem floating around with traditional Windows and all the server side stuff too, of course.
Yeah.
But the economics for native mobile apps are pitiful. Don't try something different, please. Was my sort of message there.
Okay, so we've got you know, more advanced apps. We've got the ability and the need to track a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So then what sort of, how does it work? Well, first of all, let's say this early on, there's a free demo that people can try this out, right?
Well, MarkedUp is always going to have a perpetual free tier. One of the things that was really important to us as a company was to make it so developers of any size or shape could get access for free to MarkedUp.
Okay.
And also to make sure that all new apps were always free up until a point point where they got like 20,000 monthly active users.
Okay.
We're going to be publishing pricing soon. We're not Omniture. we're not trying to charge six figures a year or something ridiculous like that. It's going to, if you have a decent sized app, you can expect to pay somewhere between, $99 and $199 a month for this.
Right.
So
okay.
That's not,
hopefully you're making a good amount more than that basically.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we only want people to use Markdup if it helps them build better apps or monetize it more effectively. Mm-hmm. So I'd say what Markdup is really designed to do is for apps where money changes hands directly between the publisher and the end user. So that means if you have a trial model in place or if you have in-app purchases or subscriptions, we want to help those developers in particular figure out who's actually buying and what they can do to sort of drive more business. We do analytics today, but our vision extends far beyond that. And what we really want to do is enable tens of thousands of small businesses to be built on top of the Windows.
Okay.
So our vision goes beyond analytics, but that's sort of our foundation for enabling all the other stuff we want to do down there.
Okay.
Do you want to talk a little bit about our technology stack and some of the neat stuff that we do under the hood?
That sounds good. So we were talking, you said you're currently using Raven, right?
Yep. So our technology stack is a blend of Amazon Web Services, Azure, and AppHarbor in terms of our cloud hosting providers. We kind of dip our toes in the water with all of them. So I guess I should start with the top down. So we have our two core parts of our sort of application that the customer touches. One is our reporting dashboard, which is sort of where you go to see all of your data and your log messages and all the other types of information Markdup captures. And then we have a little WinMD file that has the Markdup client in it. And that installs as a NuGet package.
Oh, okay.
It works equally well in WinRT and WinJS.
Let's talk about WinMD because I think that's going to be new to a lot of people.
That is good. So we can I'm going to go ahead and be a little cynical here and describe it as DLL 2.0.
Okay.
Essentially, as I'm sure every developer has noticed, WinRT is not exactly .NET. It's some kind of weird blend of .NET COM with JavaScript goodness and C++ sort of thrown into the mix.
Right.
So it's this totally new platform. What a WinMD is, essentially, is if you write a component in either C++ or C#, you have the ability to go and expose the contents of that package as long as you use WinRT types. It'll go and project out into a JavaScript interface if a WinJS user wants to go and add that component, or it'll project out into a C and C# interface, and even C and C++.
Okay.
Now, there's a couple of little nuances of how that works. For instance, it's nearly impossible to pass it's straight up impossible to pass JavaScript objects back into a WinMD interface.
Okay.
So you have to do, there's a couple of little hacks we have to do to make that tolerable for developers. So the WinMD file allows you to basically describe some interfaces that are WinRT compliant. And under the hood, you can do whatever you want. So, for instance, one of the little catches we found with WinRT is that you can't expose date time anywhere in a WinRT component. It has to be date time offset. So, and date time offset was a class I was familiar with and it was never touched ever in my 8 years or so as a .NET developer. So that took a little getting used to. And there's a number of other restrictions too. You can't expose generics on an interface because that would screw JavaScript up beyond belief. And so there's a lot, you'll get used to the sort of rules and conventions really easily. But the thing that's good about it though is you can decorate which of your interfaces are meant to be exposed and then hide all the others.
Okay.
So we have a lot of stuff under the hood that would never be serviceable in a WinRT interface. But the surface we expose to the developers is pretty well defined and we invested a lot of time to making sure that any detail we could hide if we thought it was unnecessary was hidden.
Okay. So what you were saying before I derailed you a bit, I grab a NuGet package and it's going to give me a WinMD file and then I can start programming against the types you expose and they're going to do all that logging and all that.
Yeah, exactly. So the way we architected Markdup in this case was we don't require you to instantiate any of our custom like objects or anything. We just have one sort of static class that's sort of globally available. It's sort of a managed singleton, if you will.
Okay.
And you just, in the onload method, you basically install our NuGet package and it's ready to go. And you just, inside the onload method, if you're using C#, you just call markdup.analyticclient.initialize and you paste in an API key you get from our site. And then at that point, we have a lot of automated stuff that already goes and works for you. So like we have the ability to automatically detect when a user session starts and stops. We can automatically detect if a user converted from a free app to a paid app then. We also have the ability to figure out roughly how much time a user spent inside the app.
Okay.
But then we also have other methods you may want to use too. Like if you want to track a custom event. So if you're a game developer and you want to figure out, you know, how many levels do people play through in each session on average, mm-hmm. We have the ability to make it really easy to track that. Okay. And we also have like diagnostic logging too. So if you want to log handled exceptions in your catch blocks, we have the ability to go and flatten out the stack trace and upload it to our cloud and serve it up for you on our logging, a log browser.
Okay.
But in terms of the actual architecture for all that stuff, one other thing that we did I should throw out is I talked about some of the weirdness with with JavaScript in particular.
Right.
So we actually defined a JavaScript wrapper that sits on front of our marked up WinMD file. And this allows us to go and so the developer can just go and pass off a JavaScript exception to it, and we automatically flatten it into the WinRT
right. Okay.
type. So we have some intelligence there to try to make that easier. On top of it, your namespaces get blown up like crazy when you're interface gets projected into WinJS, so you end up with this you have to go down like 4 points basically to find the actual class
name. Really?
Okay. So we went ahead and shortened it up to just MK in WinJS, so for instead of marked up dot analytic client dot WinRT dot whatever,
yeah,
the projected interface.
Okay.
And so there's I've talked to a lot of developers this week, and that's a pretty common pattern actually, is they go and build a lot of their core business logic for their Windows 8 apps in C#, ship it out as a WinMD file, and then put a JavaScript wrapper in front of it. So I was talking to one of the developers at a national publication here in the U.S., and they said that's what they did for their Windows.
Okay.
And that's a technique that I'm looking at for one of my own apps too, where I want to take care of like the network layer and how I cache images and HTML documents. It's a news reading application, mm-hmm. Hacker News.
Okay.
Go and write a little caching layer in C#, where I'm a lot stronger in terms of being able to manage the file system and all that sort of stuff. And then go and expose a simple interface out, and then just have a JavaScript wrapper that works inside WinJS. And it's easier for me to build my interface in HTML5 and JavaScript than it is XAMPP.
Ah, right. Okay.
Just because I don't have to learn something new.
That's really interesting. I've been talking to people and they're like, which do you like? And, you know, and everyone has reasons that things that you like about C# and XAML and things you like about HTML and CSS for me is a huge selling point of the WinJS yes. side, right?
Well, also those CSS3, like sort of vendor specific things that you have for WinJS are really nice. Like the Flexbox and the grid system. It's like table layout that you won't be made fun of for using. It's sort of what the grid system is.
Nice.
And on top of it, the one thing that the WinJS team did that I thought was really smart was they allowed you to use CSS media selectors to basically handle changes in orientation.
Ah.
So if you want to go, so it's yeah. kind of like responsive design, but you're actually hooked right into the event systems, right?
Okay.
So whenever your app gets put in snap view, or whenever someone changes it from landscape to portrait, it'll go and apply that media transform and automatically resize all the relevant elements to specification.
Nice. So you do all that just using CSS.
Yeah, just CSS3.
Great.
And that's really straightforward. I found that easier to work with than the XAML alternative.
Okay.
Which I don't even remember what the XAML alternative is off the top of my head. It's been so long.
Yeah. I've worked with some, but I think that there was a wrapper involved that kind of yeah. is like, a, you know, content aware whatever thing.
Yeah, content aware, layout aware container.
That's it. That's
yeah,
it.
That sounds... Yeah. I'd rather just use CSS3.
Right, exactly. Okay, so you've got that you've delivered to the client.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's talk about how that's communicating back to your services.
Right. So one thing that we had to do to be really careful about, so obviously, you know, we're an analytics component. The primary thing that our customers care about, in this case, they're app developers, mm-hmm. that they care about is maintaining a good user experience. Therefore, our SDK cannot do anything obnoxious that could possibly interfere with that. So,
right.
Our SDK never throws an exception. It basically always swallows it and shuts itself down internally.
Okay.
Normally, that's a pretty weird design goal to have on a piece of software, but this is one of those cases where that made sense.
Yeah.
We'll figure out if there's something wrong eventually with our own QA process and when customers ask us about missing data or that sort of thing, but
right.
we're better off just not screwing with the user's experience. The other thing that we do is we go ahead and want to have durable messaging on the client. So I think you're familiar with the concept of request caching when you're fetching content off the internet, right?
Right, right.
We basically do request caching for posts when we're writing it.
Ah, okay.
So we go and serialize all of our requests to disk first. We go ahead and try to send one up to our server, and we go ahead and check to see that we got a 200 level code back. And if we do, then we go ahead and delete that message from the queue, and then we send the next. We also go and meter our queue on the file system too, because one thing we don't want to do is flood the network manager.
Right.
You know, you can imagine if you have an app that is streaming media, or if you're downloading a lot of content, that'd be extremely annoying that your analytics component goes and flushes the network all at once. We are intentionally slow with our client, basically just so we can meter messages out sort of one at a time. We serialize them, so we do them one after the other. Mm-hmm. These are all like, I think there's probably some developers shrieking out there just hearing all the anti-patterns that we're doing.
Right.
But these all make sense in the context of what our goals are, which is to give the developer better analytics, but do it in a way that's non-invasive.
Yeah.
And so then all the data comes up to an HTTP API that we've built using ASP.NET MVC 4. Mm-hmm. We're not using web API because our original product dealt with image uploads and a lot of basically we did annotated screenshots for iOS, the first thing that we did.
Yeah, that's interesting. You were saying that you originally started on the idea of annotated screenshots for iOS. Mm-hmm. Over time, that morphed into analytics for WinRT development.
Yeah, well, it's I guess the cliche word for it is the pivot.
Yeah.
I'll go through and finish our, sure, our explanation, yeah, about Raven, and we'll get back into why we decided to do that and sort of, as a developer, what your process should be for thinking about whether you need to change your focus or not.
Right.
It's actually a lot more objective and data-driven than you'd like.
Huh.
Basically what we do is we have an MVC, basically a bunch of MVC 4 controllers in their own area, mm-hmm, that basically all they do is they just receive JSON objects and then they do a little bit of validation to make sure that all the necessary fields are there. We also have a health check system that tells us like, hey, this piece of information looked really weird.
Okay.
So then it flags it and a human goes and reviews it later.
Okay.
That helped us catch some issues with globalization early on where we had, fun with Unicode characters and that sort,
right,
of thing.
Yeah, I imagine that'd be really important for the kind of thing where, as you're saying, it's completely non-invasive. It's kind of a black box. You turn it on and magic happens. And
yep.
So that's very important for you on your side to be so alerted.
Yeah, most of our internal logging and stuff is used to basically troubleshoot errors with the SDK, believe it or not. So we're trying to see if there's weird, bad data coming back. And we go and look at it, try to figure out what the cause is. And usually it's pretty obvious. 99% of the time, the issue's been either a weird Unicode serialization problem, or it's been something where messages were received out of order or something like that, where a session was closed before it was started. It's like, what?
Yeah.
So occasionally that sort of stuff happens. Generally, those are pretty infrequent, though. Our SDK is designed pretty reliable. What we do is after we validated that content, we go and stick everything inside RavenDB, actually.
Okay.
And so a decision we made really early on was we evaluated Raven and Mongo side by side. I had a lot of experience with Mongo, and one of the developers on our team, I said, hey, we should take a look at Raven. And I asked him, well, sell me on it. What are the big selling points between Raven and Mongo? Because essentially the way Raven and Mongo both work is that they're document-oriented database. And for a C# developer, what you do is you just define a POCO object, and then that gets serialized to some JSON representation and saved internally. There's some semantic differences about how Raven and Mongo do that differently, but that's not really relevant for the purposes of this talk. So basically, you're just working with POCO objects that get saved to a collection. So if you have an object that defines a user and an object that defines an order, those get saved into two separate collections inside Mongo.
Mm.
Or Raven in this case. So
if you have a user has a collection of orders, then they get kind of split out?
They get split out into two different objects depending upon whether or not you want to save it as an embedded collection or as a separate collection. So
okay.
In the case, if you're working with a blog system built on Raven or Mongo, the way you'd go and save comments is you'd have them embedded into the blog post object because they're always going to be fetched in the same request, right? So there's some instances where inside Raven we go and embed sub-objects inside a parent object, and then there's some cases where it makes more sense to go and split them out. Generally, if the number of child objects in a collection is unbounded to a point where you can have a sub-collection that's in the tens of thousands,
right,
you should probably break it out into a separate collection at that point.
Right.
And just rather than have the object wholesale embedded into your parent document, go ahead and just keep a collection of IDs in there. One thing that Raven does very differently than Mongo is in Mongo there's no concept of cross-collection queries at all. You have to do what's called an app join, which is as inelegant as it sounds, where essentially you do one request, you get one set of documents back, you figure out what the foreign document identifiers are on there, and then you go and do a second request inside your app to go and get those. Raven has a couple of things it can do to sort of handle that on the server side.
Hmm.
One notion is this notion of projections, where essentially you take an index that you define, and so all Raven indexes are C-sharp classes, and so it's all link, essentially, is how you define an index.
Okay.
So you have a map operation, which defines, you know, pick objects that meet this criteria, and then you can have a reduce statement if you want to do aggregations, but you also have the ability to do what's called a projection, where essentially you might say, okay, for each one of these objects we mapped out, we're going to go ahead and load a related collection using this property on the object as a foreign document identifier, match the two together, then project them out as this type of anonymous class. And so you have the ability to go and sort of do server-side transforms on your data, which can be really effective in a lot of scenarios.
Okay.
The RavenDB client also allows you to do batch loading, where you can say, okay, so if I have this user object, I know that, or actually, we'll do it the other way. If I have this order object, I know that there's a user ID associated with it, and that's on the order.user property. Mm-hmm. So we'll go ahead and tell the RavenDB client, for every order in this query, also load the user ID property.
Right.
And it'll go and serve those up in batch. And so you still have to do a second request, technically. I'm doing the scare quotes with my fingers.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't see it on the podcast. You have to do a second request to go and get that data, but it's already been prefetched from the server. So it's like no latency to go and get it.
Okay. How about development experience-wise? So you're talking about capabilities between them. Mm-hmm. How about as far as, like, you know, developing, saving, and retrieving data? Is it relatively similar between the two?
I'd say this is where they really differ, actually. So the reason why we stuck with Raven was because MapReduce on Mongo is done as a query. And so you basically do it across the whole data set, and it's single-threaded, and even with the new aggregation framework stuff available in Mongo, that still leaves a lot to be desired. With Raven, you express MapReduce as an index. So all of your results are pre-calculated for you in an index. So serving up a time series, which is what we, you know, our primary query, is very fast. Instead of going across the data set and doing all the summation and aggregation, literally we have to go, if we're doing a time series over 30 days, we go and literally query 30 documents out of an index back. And it has all of our data sort of pre-calculated for us in POCO Plus.
Perfect.
So okay. Raven's really easy to develop against. There's a couple of quirks with it. In particular, it's sort of a, you know, you don't find out what's in it until you use it sort of thing. So, for instance, one thing that we found out that we were a little unhappy with was if you try to work with a sharded RavenDB cluster, Raven actually goes and appends the shard ID number to each of your document IDs. So if you ever pulled a shard out of your cluster, you'd have to go and manually rebalance all of your documents and go and modify the document ID,
wow,
which is a very kludgy practice. Nonetheless, we abandoned sharding on Raven after.
Okay.
Our ultimate plan is we're ultimately going to shift gears to either Cassandra or HBase or a sort of a bigger database, so to speak, for doing our analytics operations as we grow. But Raven's been working great for our initial stage. One of the limitation of it with respect to development is you don't have the ability to do what's called a MapReduce pipeline. So if you think about a query like a group by distinct operation, you know, you basically do one query that goes and fetches all of your related documents, and then you do a second MapReduce operation where you want to go and find the distinct members in there.
Right.
And Raven, that's very challenging because there's no notion of sort of multiple map reduce. You have one reduce one map operation, one reduce, and that's it. Raven does have the notion of a multi-map query, mm-hmm, where essentially you're taking documents from multiple collections and mapping them into one common format and then performing the same reduce on them. And that can be really easy. We use that a lot internally too for some of our analytics. So for instance, if we want to go and produce a time series and all the core metrics for an app, we can actually do that in one index where we have, you know, a time value, an app ID, and then we have all the different metrics we want to calculate. And so
Okay. That's
sort of how Raven works. We actually marked up open sourced a component called Hercene, which is on our GitHub profile. And that was designed to take the process of building RavenDB indexes out from application start, which is what you see in all the examples, and actually makes it a build time issue.
Right, and you were telling me that before that this is important for deployment, right? So you don't have to, like, you deploy a new build and you don't make your clients wait for that app start, right?
Well, absolutely. Well, so, you know, going and building RavenDB indexes on inside global ASAX is, and basically the way a RavenDB index usually gets built is it scans the assembly for any class that implements sort of the base what's called an abstract index creation task type. Okay. That's how Raven knows where an index is. So then it takes all of those index definitions, serializes them into this like JSON representation of link across the wire, sends it to Raven, and then Raven will go, and if it's a new index or a modified one, it'll go and update that index and add it to the server and begin sort of backfilling the index results.
Okay.
That's sort of how it works. When it has to go and serialize, you know, if you have like more than 10 indexes and you have multiple servers you're connecting to, that doesn't get very scalable, particularly considering that each index build is a blocking operation. It doesn't send its indexes in batch. It does them one at a time. So we built a tool that parallelized that and did all of it sort of at build time inside our build system, where it would go ahead and pull all the index definitions, and then it would go and spin up a bunch of async sort of threads and hit each of our servers at once and go and do an index operation that way. One other thing that's really cool about Raven that I should call out, and Hercene has the ability to do this, is you actually can get an in-memory database of Raven, and that's really useful for unit testing. You can basically spin up an entire in-memory copy of your database and unit test against it really quickly.
Okay.
One thing we'll do with Hercene is we always do a dry run to make sure our index definitions are valid before we push them to the server. And we always do that against an in-memory database.
So how's that spelled?
Hercene, HRICINE.
Okay.
So we use this build system called Albacore. It's a suite of Rake tasks. So Rake is the... Oh gosh, we're wandering way off into OSS territory.
Yeah.
So Rake is the build system that most Ruby on Rails developers are really familiar with. So if you ever need to do a database migration or schema migrations, or any number of other sort of common tasks that are real secondhand to a Ruby developer, they use a Rake task for that. A group of .NET developers really liked this programmatic and sort of procedural way of defining build jobs, and they preferred that over, you know, writing a big MS build file in XML or something.
Yeah.
This is Ruby code that's testable.
Yeah.
And so they went ahead and built a suite of Rake tasks designed for .NET developers called Albacore. It allows you to do things like run end unit tests, run MS build, go and install, basically write new, you know, package up a NuGet package if you want. There's about 30 or 40 things that you can do with it. So we have a Rake task that we run for Hercene, where after we've gone and built all of our assemblies and after our big end unit test bank is passed, we have about 200 of them that we run on the server.
Okay.
Time. Once those are all done, we go and run Hercene. We do a dry run against an in-memory database, and then we do a production build.
Okay.
And then once all that's finished, we can easily go and write our Hercene task to go and deploy to Azure or do a Git push to AppHarbor if we wanted to. We're actually okay making production deployments manual. That's one of those things where you don't want to give your guys enough rope to hang themselves
right.
with. you don't want someone to be doing a test build and then have their eyes go saucer wide when they see, oh my gosh, all the tests passed, but this feature was totally not ready to
ship
yet.
Right.
So that's we're pretty cool, you know, automating builds for staging and development servers and our personal environments. But for production, we always leave it manual.
Okay. You mentioned that, you know, you're happy with RavenDB at this point, but you're looking at like HBase or I forget the other one.
Cassandra.
Cassandra, right. And so what would be the reasons for that? Just scalability or?
So Raven's big limitation that it has, it doesn't have very good options for scale out. Its sharding sort of system is fairly primitive, even compared to MongoDB. And with a system like ours, even with master-master replication, we have multiple writable heads. Mm-hmm. Consistency issues can be kind of scary.
Right.
And the other little issue with it is just that if you rely on indexes real heavily in Raven, like how we do, the way Raven queries against the sharded cluster like that is it hits each node in the cluster sequentially or in parallel, both of which kind of defeat the purpose of sharding, in my opinion.
Okay.
So it's I'm sure if Oren listens to this, I'll get an earful from him. But overall, we really like Raven as a product, and we're going to continue to use it in perpetuity for a lot of things. The fact that it's built on top of Lucene and gives us full text search for things like our documentation and other parts is really nice. Ultimately, we're going to move to a system that can do what we call linear hardware scale. So for us, our needs as far as an analytics database really boil down to two things. Being able to handle big burst loads in terms of writes. So that means we might need to be able to add new nodes very quickly on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to handle burst elasticity is part of it. The second is when we add new types of queries that we make available to our end users. You know, imagine if you have a data set that's in the terabyte ring. Going and being able to backfill those query results because you haven't been able to do incremental MapReduce. use because those queries didn't exist until you added them.
Right, right.
One thing you might need to be able to do is fire up a ton of workers to go and, you know, backfill the results and then spin them back down to a normal load when you just start doing incremental reduce going forward.
Right.
So we needed a system that could do both of those really easily. And when we evaluated our options, I mean, we took a look at OLAP and SQL Server and decided that that didn't really meet our constraints as far as easy sort of scalar, you know, linear scalability go. And so we're taking a close look at sort of the Hadoop ecosystem, and HBase and Cassandra both have similar design principles behind them. They're kind of based off of Bigtable, the Google Bigtable. Mm-hmm. So they're column-oriented databases. And one thing that both of them do reasonably well is they have things like distributed atomic counters for incrementing values as they come in, which is important if you want to do real-time analytics. That way you're sort of processing results as the requests come in. And you have this data point that'll become eventually consistent when you do real batch processing over all the documents later using Hadoop or Hive. But with those sort of distributed counters, you can just go and count stuff that's coming in, knowing that you might be overcounting some stuff if you get like a duplicate request that gets filtered out by the MapReduce job later,
right. Okay.
Or something like that. But it sort of gives you a variety of tools. And for us, the most important thing is just being able to throw hardware at the problem is sort of a correctly designed solution for a company like ours is, you know, one of my engineers comes back to me and says, hey man, the, you know, SLA for computing, you know, fresh data for our user has gone from 1 hour to 4. And I hand them our credit card and basically say, okay, I want you to go ahead and double our Azure instances or something.
Right.
You know? It's like, yeah, just throw more hardware at it. Scalability is one of those things where it's, you know, there's the correct solution for your business looks a lot different depending upon where the bottleneck is. And for us, it's just our ability to go and handle sort of dynamic loads that are pretty large,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to catch up if we need to. Right now, Raven's been able to hold up just fine, and that's because we're still at a point in our company where we have a relatively small number of customers than what we expect to have down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Once we're doing data for, you know, 100,000 plus apps, and we have some of them that are pretty big, and we're doing over 1 billion events a day, then
right.
then our requirements look a lot different than when we're doing, you know, hundreds of thousands to 1 million events a day. Just a different set of concerns.
So let's talk about starting a company.
Right.
I'm not sure where to start. I guess you start by hiring some people, right?
You start with, I think ultimately a startup really begins with something you want to set out to go do. So if any of you sort of listening to the podcast feel nervous about starting a business, I would say that's the first sign that something is very right to you. Starting a business is scary, and it should be. It's really for people who want to put something out there that doesn't exist the way they see it today. So the real problem that we looked at with Marked Up originally, and why I'll talk about our pivot too when we get down into
sure.
it. Our original mission was to make the process of building sort of commercially and economically sustainable apps easier. And to try to basically make it so developers could monetize and iterate and ship their apps with a lot more speed and success than they would have otherwise. That's sort of our vision for our company. Was we took a look in particular at the Windows Phone ecosystem and iOS too, and just saw, like, you know, there's a lot of developers putting hundreds of hours worth of work into each one of these apps, and, you know, maybe if they're just doing it for fun, then that's totally fine. But some of them want to see some income come out of it.
Right.
I think, I mean, you tell me, I think every single developer has had the fantasy of producing some asset that just brings value back.
Right, sure.
Right? I just want to go and produce this little web app. I don't need it to be a six-figure business, but just, you know, being able to bring home an extra couple $1,000 a month and be able to, you know, buy, you know, some new Xbox games or take the family on a nice trip. That's all my goals are with a software company, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I think every developer's had that sort of fantasy. And I think a lot of them were really disappointed with how iOS and Windows Phone panned out in terms of, wow, it's a lot harder than I thought to actually get people to pay for stuff.
Yeah.
And to make sure that we're asking them the right way to pay for things. These are problems that are very closely coupled to the sort of software development experience, but you don't really think about it until you see it happening in front of you. So getting back to starting a company, you know, mm-hmm. so I guess we have a kind of a recursive mission, I guess. We started a company to help make it easier for other developers to start companies. The first thing you have to do is have a mission. So I went ahead and explained ours. Then the second is you have to go and take a close look in the mirror and be like, are we the right people to try to realize this though? You know, if I wanted to go and build the next social app for, I don't know, sharing pet photos or something.
Right.
Actually, ironically enough, I did build one. Well, so that's probably a bad example. I'll use an example. Am I the best person to go and ship that? And I would take a close look and be, you know, it probably should be someone like I Can Has Cheeseburger or, you know, a 4chan or somebody who should go out and do that. They really know how to manage content and figure out what's funny and put it out there in a much more effective way than I can. But once you've gone and passed that snuff test where you'd be like, you know, this is an idea that I believe in. I think I'm the right person to execute it. And the next thing you have to go do is actually validate whether or not this is something worth doing. Is there a business to be made doing it? And so there's two different, depending upon what your business looks like, there's two different things you have to do. If you're going into a space where it's sort of the problem is well understood and there's a lot of people doing it either in different sectors or aren't doing it very well in the sector you want to enter into, then at that point you don't need to go through the process of establishing whether this is actually a problem or not. By virtue of the fact that there's other profitable companies in existence doing something similar, you know you're generally looking in the right direction.
Right.
So the next thing you got to do is, well, is my specific vision for what we want to go out and do, is it economically viable is what you have to ask. And the first place you should just go and start is take some people who are your friends and say, you know what, please don't BS me here. Just be honest. You know, would you pay for this? And most of them are going to give you pretty positive feedback because they all want to see you succeed and help you. But you know, we're probably all fortunate enough to have some friends who will just tell us the unvarnished truth no matter what.
Yeah.
And listen to what they have to say. And they'll ask you questions. And everyone has their own biases when it comes to talking about it. Our company Marked Up works out of an accelerator in Los Angeles alongside, about 8 other companies. And so one of them builds like a real consumer facing app. And they ask me, hey, Aaron, what do you think of this? And I go, you know, I'm pretty much the worst target demographic you could possibly ask for this. So any feedback I give you, good or bad, will only screw you up. Basically, go and pick people who you think are your target customer and ask them questions. And they may not, and it turns out that what you're building might actually be really applicable somewhere else too. And before you sit down and build anything, go and start asking questions. And so then after you've done that for a little while, you'll know when you're at a point where you decide that this is something worth embarking on. Mm-hmm. I'd say the next thing is if you're a developer, you have to understand that you're in the most powerful position to start a company out of almost any other type of person out there. The reason is you have the tools to actually build it. And it's all knowledge and practice and experience that you've accrued working for someone else for a number of years. Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is interesting. Yeah. You think about that. You want to start a restaurant?
Yeah.
You need some money. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, you do.
And you need like, or like in a lot of businesses, like you can't just show up and ship, you know, something or, you know, because people want to see, well, what's your qualifications? Whereas with software, it's like, hey, the app's pretty good.
Software is a very democratic business to be in. I mean, if you want to take a look at the ultimate laissez-faire sort of capitalism, you know, consumer apps and web apps is the ultimate thing. You know, the reason why consumer has been a big trend among investors for the past few years, it's not anymore, by the way, in case you guys are wondering. but the reason why it was hot for so long was because anyone could go and enter into it. There was no barrier to entry like how there was with enterprise software. So being a developer gives you a lot of power when it comes to starting a company. So the next thing to do is, you know, there's a methodology out there called the Lean Startup. It's kind of a shame that movement has had so much marketeering stuff plastered over it because it becomes difficult to separate the value from the sizzle, so to speak. but there is a lot of value to it. So going out and building what's called a minimally viable product is a really good place to start. And what an MVP should look like, your first one, you should be ashamed of it. If you aren't, then you spent too long working on it.
Okay.
Put something out there that you have no intention of selling and have no intention of like actually signing up users for. Just like a little proof of concept prototype.
And this is something you show to people you trust.
Exactly. Show it to people you trust. So let's take a step back in the time machine and talk about the first product Marked Up built. We came out of Startup Weekend in Los Angeles and we built the functional version of our first product in about 48 hours. So if you think about that, that was 4 of us working together. One iOS engineer, one back-end engineer who's still working on Marked Up to this day, and one really good front-end and slash designer guy, and then there was me, basically. I'm a back-end engineer primarily, but my real job with the Startup Weekend was basically just to make sure all the wood was going behind one arrow. So, So having a little bit of project management experience doesn't hurt. So we built our first little product in 48 hours, and we ended up taking second place at Startup Weekend.
Nice.
And got flown up to a launch conference up in San Francisco. And so then we decided, okay, our Startup Weekend prototype barely worked. We had to fake some stuff manually.
Yeah.
Like the screenshot upload didn't actually work and all this stuff. So our first product, the more we got our name from, was the ability to annotate iOS screenshots.
Ah, right.
So you'd go and drop a little SDK in your iOS app, and during development time, you can go ahead and say, you could circle something with your finger on the app and say, oh man, this piece of UI is wrong. You need to do this. It would get uploaded into a central repository and distributed to the development team.
Yeah.
So people would go and see all this, and they could see who sent the feedback, and developers could comment on it, convert it to a GitHub issue, all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
That's what the ultimate finished product did. It started Weekend, we just built something that, made a pretty picture, appear to go from an iPad to a web
app. Right.
And so we decided, okay, for launch conference, which was a week after Startup Weekend, we needed to go and build something that was, this is a bigger stage, and
yeah.
Both literally and figuratively.
Right.
So we need to do something a little better. So we built another MVP, and this one did was there was no account management, no security at all. It was just would take an upload and just paste it directly into a page that was written with a bunch of like cross-domain AJAX and all sorts of horrible stuff. It was a complete abomination for many developers. But you know what it did? It got people really excited at launch conference, got us a lot of good introductions, and encouraged us to keep going and to go and try to iterate on it a third time. So the third product took us about 6 to 8 weeks to build, which is about how long we figured. And this is all in our spare time, by the way. Don't quit your job when you're doing this part.
Well, and that is an interesting thing to mention, is that Microsoft has a pretty decent moonlighting policy.
Yes.
A lot of companies do, and that is nice. It's like you don't have to choose.
With Microsoft's moonlighting policy, when we started getting serious, we took a really close look at it. And they're as far as employers go, very progressive about it. Essentially, as long as you're not either stealing Microsoft property or have a conflict of interest, they're pretty much okay with it.
Right.
So, so if you're doing stuff on nights and weekends, and it's not something that intrudes on Microsoft's, sort of business interests, then they're going to be pretty liberal about it.
I guess that is something, though, depending on other employees.
In California, if you're in the state of California, your employers can't really do a whole hell of a lot to you. As long as you aren't, doing something egregious, like, taking code you wrote at work and embedding it into your app.
Right.
Thankfully, I was in the evangelism job, so I'd never had any code that made it into a Microsoft product.
Right.
But the gist of it is, so we built this next version of the product, and this was the one that was ready to be put in the hands of end users.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually, I basically went and I met with a couple of companies I'd worked with real closely when I was at Microsoft, and these were people, they were still my personal friends, but they had businesses to run too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put it in the hands of like their lead iOS developer, and the reason why we ended up pivoting away from that version of Marked Up was the developer, the product guys and the CTOs really got the value of it, but the developers themselves were like, what the hell is this? Why would I ever use it?
Okay.
So we took a hard look in the mirror, and we're like, if developers don't like our product, they're going to find the first chance to pull it out. Mm-hmm. On top of it, the economics for that stuff, when we started figuring out what people would pay for it, and you have to ask, was not very good. There's no way we'd be able to build a sustainable business. So we started shifting towards this view of being able to help the developers manage their apps. Managing the feedback from an app is sort of one thing that you can do. We can also manage the behavior of it as it runs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of the direction we started going with Marked Up. And we had to build an analytics platform to go and support it. And as I get to learn more and more about Windows 8, I realize, holy crap, this ecosystem is radically different than iOS in terms of the way the economics will work. So we should go down that road. So then there came an inflection point when we started going down the path of building our next product where, it was time to put up or shut up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you want to really start a company and make it work? So the first thing you should do is talk to a lawyer.
Really?
Yes, the first thing you should do is talk to a lawyer. And the reason why I say that is you have to think about, well, this is going to be the first cost to your business,
mm-hmm.
but particularly if you're working with other people, something needs to own the intellectual property.
I was going to say too, up to this point, you've been doing, it's a bunch of guys having fun working together,
mm-hmm.
right? But then thinking about who owns what, or if you're the lead and you're paying people, are you paying them with equity or, all that kind of stuff?
So that's
the lawyer's job.
The lawyer's job is to give you a structure to figure all that out.
Okay.
So, one thing you'll get educated on is different types of corporate structures. So we started off this what's called a limited liability corporation. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty good place to start because it gives you the flexibility to change to other types of so all publicly traded companies are what's called a C corporation.
Right.
And they're governed differently. They have a board of directors and all that stuff. And they're taxed differently too. An LLC is a pretty decent place to start because it gives you the ability to convert to a C corp later. It's pretty much impossible to convert to a C corp back into an LLC. So it's, you know, this sort of only moves in one direction. So we started with an LLC and we went ahead and went down the rails and basically came up with a structure for figuring out sort of how to keep employees around legally in terms of, because there's, you know, a lot of it's tax paperwork, all that stuff.
Right.
And how, and basically came up with a structure for figuring out how many units of equity should belong to each person. And so we lost two people from our team, two of the original guys having fun when it came down to actually incorporating. Because they just took a look in the mirror and were like, you know, I either have other commitments that I can't look back from, mm-hmm. or I just don't have enough time to invest into this, or I'm just not that interested in the idea. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't really matter what the reasons are, but people will leave at that point if you're working with other folks. And so once you've had a chance to sort of figure out what your costs are going to be to incorporate and whether or not you're willing to take on that burden of managing all that, then you have to make a call whether or not you actually want to pay for incorporating and take all that legal paperwork on. And once you do that, it's actually pretty painless. And then you start talking about payment and compensation. And so the right way, particularly when you're thinking about hiring, the right way to think about it is every person is motivated by difference. There's some folks who, you know, basically ownership and basically equity is more important to them initially than money is. One expectation everybody should have at a startup is that you're going to go without a salary for some time, either until you guys raise some money or you have revenue or whatever it is. So everyone needs to just be realistic about that. Basically, if you can't afford to work without pay for at least some period of time, then you either should only do this as a moonlighting thing or you should not do it at all. Because there's, you know, realistically, and I'm saying this out there as a plea to the people applying for jobs at really early stage companies. There's gonna be salary options available after someone raises money or they have some capital in the bank somehow, but there's gonna be a period, and it usually lasts, I'd say, between 3 and 6 months, where you're operating sort of out of your savings. Mm-hmm. And that's the first part where it gets real.
Yeah.
And that's the, and when you make the call about trying to decide if you want to go full time or not, that's the first thing you have to look at. How much runway do you have? So, you know, for the way I timed it, I had a bonus from Microsoft coming right around the corner. And I'd been around just long enough where even if I left on like August 10th, which is when I did, I'd still get paid in September.
Okay.
So I knew that I had plenty of runway to go and do this. So, and Eric, our other teammate, has one more year to go at college. And he worked for me for a year as sort of an SI, as a contractor, and was able to do good work. So I knew that his risk tolerance was pretty high.
Right, too, right.
Because he's, you know, not paying for anything yet. So he and I started working together, and now we're at a point where we just hired our first two employees.
Okay.
I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit, but I guess I should go back to making the decision to go full-time.
Mm-hmm.
If you validated your idea, you've demonstrated to yourself that you can execute on it pretty well, and you have, you know, other people who are willing to support you, whether financially or whether they're willing to work with you or be early customers, then I think that's the point where you need to make a decision, how important is the meet. Mm-hmm. And if it's really important, if you really want to see it through to execution, then you should make the decision to go full. It is very difficult to start a business where you only can give it 20% of your attention. That was the thing that changed most radically, was when I went full time on Marked Up, our ability to produce just, you know, like went up about 15x.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Because I had your full attention.
It had my full attention.
Absolutely. And also had your, you're motivated too, right?
Yeah. When you only get to eat what you kill, that's a big motivator. So then the next step when after you've decided to go full time is, okay, how are we going to pay for ourselves once our bank accounts are getting low?
Mm-hmm.
So you either have to have a plan for monetizing and getting customers real quickly or raising money.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, the inflection point for how you should decide, you know, which avenue you want to go down is, where do you think your strengths are? If you're a developer and you've never raised money or acquired customers before, then that's probably not very helpful. But what it boils down to is, can you get a product out in market quickly that people would be willing to pay for? And can you prove that along the way? And that's one decision that might sort of lead you to go down the monetization route first. Or the other thing you can look at is, take a look in the mirror and be like, am I a person that investors would treat credibly? And the way investors will look at you is, what's your prior experience? They're going to want to know what you've done before the startup.
Mm-hmm.
If you knew a bunch of investors, you know, people who do angel investing before you left, that helps a lot. And that's the primary reason why Marked Up's been able to raise a little bit of money, is just because, in fact, by virtue of the fact that I worked in the startup ecosystem,
right.
I got to know a lot of them, and they got to go, oh, this... this Aaron guy seems relatively not insane to me. he's not going to go and take any money I give him and blow it on, drugs and alcohol.
Right.
So, take a look in the mirror. And the other thing I ought to say is if you're a technical person and you can give a really convincing business argument for why your company should exist, that is very attractive to investors. Technical founders get an edge.
Oh.
Obviously, in terms of the stack rank, entrepreneurs with a prior success are the very top of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. Then right below them are sort of, entrepreneurs who've done this before and demonstrated competency, even if they weren't successful the first time around.
Right.
And then after that, it's, I'd say technical founders who have a coherent vision and a reasonably methodical plan to go and execute it.
Right.
And these are things that developers should be good at. Mm-hmm. If you have a good vision for what your product should do, honestly, spend a lot of time talking about it and socializing. Your primary job as a founder is to evangelize what you do.
Mm-hmm.
To both the customers, to investors, and to people you want to hire them.
So you're saying just practicing is helpful, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Present to two types of people, friendlies and unfriendlies. Having your ass kicked every now and then is a good thing when you're an entrepreneur. It's a reality check.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you watched Deadliest Catch at all, but it was an episode where the captain's under the boat and he's like trying to fix a weld on there, and the boat dips down hard and just nearly knocks the guy unconscious.
Wow.
Occasionally you have to have that happen to you to let you know you were doing something really stupid. and that was the lesson he took away too, incidentally. So pitching in front of people who are not going to give you nice feedback is good. Just make sure they're also not the same people who are going to influence your ability to raise money down the road.
Right.
So I would say other entrepreneurs you're acquaintances with are a good source for that. The other thing is, investing a lot into actually going and networking and meeting other people in the space, both other entrepreneurs and investors, doing that before you jump in full time is probably a good idea. Because that way you have the ability to sort of build up rapport. And one thing that investors do not like is getting mobbed at conferences by people who need a check. If they get to slowly know you when there's no, so think of it like dating, right?
Right.
They get to meet you in a comfortable context and there's no ulterior motive yet or anything like that. It's just kind of, it's easier for them to get familiar with you and make it feel better making a decision about you.
Yeah.
The one thing that an investor's really going to want to bet on more than anything else, they bet on people. They don't bet on products so much. Because the product like ours can change.
Yeah.
But the people responsible for it are the real asset that's going to deliver value down the road.
Okay.
So, have a very people-oriented approach to how you, to how you go and try to build your business. I'd say the other thing is, the general sort of lesson about running a company is it's an emotional roller coaster. You'll have great days, you'll have terrible days, and they can happen at the same time, actually. it's very, very sort of string theory in that respect. Just basically, you have to have the discipline to not let any of those things rile you up. Knowing the point when you should quit is pretty much when you're forced to quit, or when the economics look so bad that there's just no practical option to keep going forward. So that's if you'll know when that happens too. It'll be self-evident. Usually it'll be an angry phone call from someone who needs a bill for them. Just stick with what you're doing. Obviously take in data points and change your tactics along the way, but just don't quit is the most important thing. As Woody Allen says, 80% of success is showing up.
Yeah.
Well, if you never even try to put a product in market, if you don't try to talk to customers, and if you don't try to talk to people you want to hire, then you're never going to do well. So, just have the discipline to not let any of it bother you.
I like where we started with some of this where, you're talking about, hey, this is some fun stuff in your free time, moonlighting, right? And you kind of see where it goes, and you put more effort into it as you see it going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like, I don't know, with anything, it's like nobody, I've got three kids, and if people are like, wow, three kids, that's crazy, or whatever, more than one kid even is people, but I talk to my parents, they've got five kids, and they're like, well, they didn't all appear all at once.
Yeah, exactly.
You have one at a time, you kind of grow into something, right?
Yeah, quintuplets are rare for
yeah,
a reason.
Fortunately.
But yeah, generally speaking, it's a matter of incrementally,
Yeah.
The whole startup execution model is very incrementalist.
Mm-hmm.
So know, with us, we went ahead and have a little soft launch where we don't do any PR or marketing. We just sort of put it out there and let people play with it. And that's sort of, we did that primarily to get a source of feedback to tell us what's wrong and what we should be fixing and what's missing. And that's, that way when we go and do a big top-down PR launch where we try to get, you know, big publications to cover us and everything, we're ready for it at that point.
Right.
You know, so that, and it's the same to starting the business or hiring people. You want to do it slowly at first where you just want to, you know, wade into it. And then there's that point when you jump full in and decide to really commit to it. Then at that point, obviously, you have to start doing stuff a lot faster. But you have to be tender about this and understand that everything's a process and that you won't immediately be successful. But you it's sort of, you want, I guess, eventual consistency is sort of what you're shooting for. When you're first getting started with a new venture, as long as your failures and your successes kind of offset each other, you're probably doing pretty well. At some point, you need, you know, the green column to start going up at a faster rate than the red one does.
Right.
And that's called lift in the startup space.
Okay.
But,
well, we should,
wrap it up.
We should finish, but I would like to talk about how people can try this out. So you mentioned the, how should people get started? They go to markedup.com and...
So to get started with the Markedup, you should go to markedup.com. And basically, if you have a GitHub account, you can just go ahead and click Login with GitHub and we'll automatically do single sign-on for you there. If you don't have a GitHub account, you should just go to the registration page and create a username and password. And now currently you need a registration code to join. If you type in herding code, that'll work. And you can just go ahead and pass right through the door.
Great.
Yep.
Okay, well, thanks a bunch for your time.
Thanks, John.
Really interesting... talking about a lot of different things, and so
absolutely. And if anyone out there is thinking about starting a company and wants to ask me a question, you can reach out to me at aaron@markedup.com. I'd be more than happy to help a brother out, so to speak, or sister in this case.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot. We'll be talking to you again soon on Herding Code.
Thank you.